Just before we get into this week's podcast with Drs. Joseph McCullough and Tommy Wood, I wanted to tell you about a very special Indiegogo campaign that it would make our MBT hearts sing if we could get funded. It's being organised by previous podcast guests, Rob Abbott, MD, do you remember Tommy interviewed him? And then Angie Ault and Mickey Trescott. And these guys, they're trying to fund a study of the autoimmune paleo diet and its effectiveness for treating Hashimoto's thyroiditis. These guys have actually done this once before. They published a study in 2016 that showed an incredible 73% remission rate in Crohn's and colitis. The autoimmune paleo protocol was a huge part of my journey to recovery. When I went to the gastroenterologist in about 2012, they told me that my diet was nothing to do with my problems and that all they had for me was steroid anti-inflammatory drugs. And then when those stopped working and they told me they would stop working, there would be surgery. And at that time, I was lucky enough to meet my wife who had been studying food allergies in the lab. And she told me I absolutely must try an elimination diet before going down the steroid and surgery route. And the only thing my wife could find at the time was the autoimmune paleo diet. And she said, this sounds about right. And there were no resources really available at that time. There were just a couple of websites. I don't even think there was a single cookbook. And of course, all of that has changed in the last 5 years. But it's still all anecdotal. I think you'll probably get exactly the same experience if you went back to that same gastroenterologist. And I don't blame the gastroenterologist. They're just doing what the evidence tells them to do. And so the problem that we're trying to solve with this Indiegogo campaign is to create some science that will guide that gastroenterologist into better decisions in the future. So it would really, really help me out. And these guys that are trying to organize this study, if you could head over to the Indiegogo campaign, they're only looking for $10,000. Tommy and I have both pitched in $500. I think between us, the listeners to this podcast, we can easily get this thing funded. So I will link to the Indiegogo campaign in the show notes for this episode that you can find over at nourishbalancethrive.com/podcast. And I'll also set up a redirect. nourishbalancethrive.com/AIP will also take you to the Indiegogo campaign. But perhaps the show notes is the easiest place to find the link to the campaign. Over at the show notes, you'll also find all of the things that are mentioned in this podcast with Dr. Tommy Wood and Joseph McCullough, including all of the scientific references. Now, over to the podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Nourish, Balance, Thrive podcast. My name's Tommy Wood, and today I'm joined by somebody who I'm sure needs no introduction, Dr. Joseph McCullough. Hi, thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me, Tommy. Glad to be here.
I'm glad too, and I'm actually going to start by mentioning my mum, who was my first ever podcast listener and is also a big fan of yours. She's a professor of environmental sustainability and a pretty old school kind of hippie. I remember a few years ago she said that if she was ever wondering about whether something was worth thinking about in terms of health, she always checked to see what Dr. McCullough had said about it first. So.
That's a great story.
So I'm hoping she'll enjoy this episode. And I think it's probably apt that we're talking about something that's potentially controversial, but probably shouldn't be, and that's the health effects of electromagnetic radiation or electromagnetic fields, EMFs. This is a topic that I've actually thought about for a few years, and I've always intended to bring it up on the podcast, but it's kind of tricky because there's a lot of scaremongering, as you know. Many of the people talking about it are fairly easy to discredit for various reasons. And a lot of the papers in the published literature, sadly, are quite poorly written or come from countries or institutions that may have less rigorous research practices, or at least that's what we might think. However, you know, if we go just to basic physics principles, I think EMFs should have some kind of biological effect. And I actually mentioned this at a conference a few years ago, and people looked at me like I had two heads, and I'm sure you're familiar with that. Almost everything in the body works by the movement of charged particles. And when charged particles move, they create electromagnetic fields, and electromagnetic fields interact, which is why I got in trouble when I put a magnet on top of the TV when I was a kid, right? Because it sort of warps the screen. And this is particularly true for mitochondria, which are capacitors and move electrons. That's all they do. And they create fields that fluctuate as they do that. So hopefully we'll cover all the different parts of the body and why fields might be able to interact. So then I wanted to think about this for a while. And I know you were talking to Chris recently, and this is a topic that you've focused on a lot. Been on various podcasts, interviewed a lot of experts. I think you're writing a book, written a paper. And because I have an audience that has quite a lot of healthcare professionals, scientists, I'd like to ask you about the best way to get this message out and the kind of people that should do that. And the reason why I ask you that is because I know your relationship with the traditional academic and medical fields has been tumultuous at times. So how do we get this message out without sort of some of the issues that we've had previously?
Well, I think first step is to understand what the problem is so that you can explain it in a rational and scientific method. And I think that the studies have been done and published, and we can do that now. So I think that's the very first step, because it is a complex issue and it's muddied quite considerably, very similarly to big food and big pharma, who have enormous amounts of resources to skew the truth and fund federal regulatory agencies to pass misinformation and disinformation. So the telecommunications dwarf both of those industries combined. So it's like big pharma on steroids. They're really able to significantly discredit credible researchers and spin off a dozen other studies to debunk theirs and to essentially control the appropriate federal regulatory agencies to essentially believe these lies that are being spun by them. And we can go into what those lies are, the fundamental lies that contribute to the confusion.
Yeah, I think hopefully when we go into some of the mechanism, we can cover that. And when the political topics come up, it's very easy for people to sort of say this is tinfoil hats and this isn't really happening. Mm-hmm. But you read papers in the literature which show that if something's been funded by the telecoms industry, then they're much less likely to show an effect compared to those that are more independently funded. You know, that's in the published research. And actually, very interesting, I was watching an interview with Ole Johansson, who's a professor at the Karolinska, I'm sure you know. And he mentioned on stage that if you were thinking about going into this field, just don't do it because your research will be slammed and your funding will be cut off and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, there are certainly very credible people to whom this is been happening. Before we sort of dive into the science and maybe the politics, can you give us an overview, the types of fields, electric, magnetic, radio frequencies, what generates them, and the sort of frequencies involved in all the basic physics there?
Well, they're all encumbered under the term EMF, but they're broadly characterized into three different categories. One is magnetic fields. The other are the electric fields, which is really the bugaboo and the most challenging to measure accurately, and it contributes to loads of confusion. And then the radio frequency fields.
Okay, so in terms of our exposures, that's obviously something that we're potentially worried about in terms of health. Where are these coming from? And then maybe also how are we quantifying that? And how has that exposure increased in terms of human history or recently?
Well, let's go back to the exposure first, that humans have increased over the last century. And if we go to the end of World War I, around 1918 or so, and start at that point, and examine the frequency of 1 gigahertz, which is a radio frequency, and very close to the ones that are used in your cell phone and Wi-Fi routers, and you establish it as a baseline, the level that was in ambient radiation in 1918, and compare it to 2018, how much do you think the increase has been over that 100-year period?
I'm going to cheat because I think I know the answer.
Okay, go ahead.
I think it's 1 quintillion times.
That's correct. Which is a billion billion. So that's a lot of times. And you'd have to be irrational to even think that that increase in exposure couldn't have some biological impact. I mean, it just has to.
Yeah. I guess, you know, we talk about the average total exposure. What amount of time are people spending in fields that are having this kind of biological effect? And I think this comes down to many people now have said that there's basically no control population anymore, right? There's no population or very few populations that we can compare ourselves to anymore because everybody's being exposed. So this makes it difficult both to figure out what the effect is because there's nobody to compare us to. There's no control group. You know, what percentage of the time are we being exposed to this? And then how can we start to discern that it might actually be causing an effect?
The general principle to whether it's causing an effect tends to be akin to what we notice in medicine, as you well are aware, that most diseases don't present themselves until you've had they're 80% of the way there. And some diseases, like heart disease, don't give you a symptom until you have 100% of the symptoms, like sudden death, which is the most common symptom of heart disease. So most people are having biological impacts as a result of these exposures, but have no appreciation of the damage that it's causing until it's too late. But there was a controlled exposure, and it's interesting, I'm not sure if you've encountered it in your review, but in the beginning of the 20th century, there were two populations in the United States. There was a rural population and the urban, and the urban was electrified for the most part and continued to be electrified. Rural was not electrified and continued to be not electrified until about 1950. And Sam Milham was an MD epidemiologist who painstakingly put together the statistics and showed really clearly that there was a wide difference in the amount of disease mortality from heart disease and cancers and diabetes in the urban population that had the electric field exposures versus the rural. And then these curves collided. They went together in about 1950 when both populations.
So what about the other fields, mm-hmm. things that people probably talk about more frequently, Wi-Fi, cell phone towers, cell phones right. themselves, because the catch-up between the urban and rural populations was much faster. It would have happened within a matter of years. So is it possible to pick up any signal in terms of the epidemiological effects there?
I don't think so, because as you mentioned, the increase has been quite dramatic and relatively recent. As far as I know, there have been really no epidemiological studies with almost the number of cell phones in the world equaling the number of people in the world now. It's the rare individual mm-hmm. community that doesn't have these exposures. So the Wi-Fi frequencies are real similar to your cell phones. And many people don't really appreciate that the frequencies coming from the Wi-Fi are significant. And this is definitely part of the problem, is that you can't see it, you can't hear it, you can't feel it. You can become somewhat skeptical that they're safe as they're being promoted. But when you can't see or hear or feel it, and there's enormous, absolutely enormous convenience as a result of using these technologies, the tendency is to not want to believe it. To be skeptical, because yeah. it's just going to really put a challenge to your appropriate implementation of this, because so many people are in denial. And this includes many naturally oriented healthcare professionals. The last lecture I gave was a few weeks ago in Colorado Springs, and the lecturer before me was a cardiologist, actually well-known, Tom Levy, who's written a lot of books on vitamin C. And literally, in his presentation, his cell phone rings, and he pulls it out of his breast pocket right over his heart. So this is exactly the behavior, even among the leaders in the field. They're in denial.
So if you're faced with somebody like that in front of you, and all of these things are true, you can't see, hear, feel them, everybody is exposed, so you don't have a control mm-hmm. population to compare them to, how do you begin to construct an argument to convince somebody that this is actually something that they should be paying attention
well,
to?
Well, fortunately, that work has been done. To do it independently would be a real challenge, but there's some incredible research scientists who have done precisely that. The primary one, who I think really deserves a Nobel Prize for it, is Dr. Martin Paul, who's a PhD, and he's got his PhD from Caltech, not an insignificant institute, and his BA was from Johns Hopkins. And he's a really good molecular biologist and biophysicist. And he didn't do the actual research, but compiled about 24 studies that were done evaluating the impact on calcium channel blockers on EMF toxicity. All these studies noticed really consistently was there was a radical attenuation of the damage that was done in cell cultures and in animals. So you can conduct control experiments to identify the pathology. And that's probably the best way to make the distinction in the lab, because it's difficult to do it otherwise.
Maybe that's a good way to segue into mechanism. And I know one of the main people in the field is Martin Paul. The voltage-gated calcium channels, the VGCCs, getting activated, large influxes of calcium into the cell, which can cause mitochondrial damage, can cause cell death, oxidative stress, all that down those pathways. But then I know there are some other theories like that from Paul Haru, who thinks it's more of a direct effect on water and electrons within the mitochondria, which again would have the same downstream effects, could increase the production of reactive oxygen species. He talks about the inappropriate activation of AMPK. Are there any other theories? Do you, having interviewed so many people, and I know you've read a lot about this, can we sort of integrate all the different thoughts on what mechanisms might be underlying some of the issues?
I'm more in favor of Martin's work, and it just mm-hmm. seems to me there's a lot more support for it. And I've interviewed Paul Haro, and I found his argument somewhat confusing. You know, they may be valid and more significant than Paul's, but my guess is it's not. But either way, the underlying cause, as you mentioned, is an increase in oxidative stress, which you can partially remediate. And in Paul's work, of course, it was the using calcium channel blockers. And I think we're both not mm-hmm. big fans of using pharmacological approaches to remediation. So a natural equivalent of that would be magnesium, which can mm-hmm. serve in many cases as a natural calcium channel blocker. And as you well know, it's most people, well over 80% of the population is probably deficient in magnesium. And it's yeah. crucial, vital mineral that is required for, I think, 400 different enzymes functions in the body. So you're not going to cause any major downsides by taking magnesium.
Except for maybe a little bit of GI distress, but that's about it.
And it's difficult to overdose because of that very side effect. You'll excrete it before you get into problems.
One of the other benefits of magnesium, we're talking about VGCCs and their presence in the brain, glutamate, excitotoxicity, overactivation of excitatory neurons, magnesium actually directly binds to one of the glutamate receptors and can reduce some of the activity there. So like can improve things potentially on multiple levels. I actually wanted to quickly get back to the Paul Haru thing. I must say that even though Martin Paul has published much more widely, my personal bias is always that if there was going to be effect, it was going to be at the mitochondrial level because that's where they are moving electrons, they are generating fields of their own. And he mentioned something that I thought was interesting, which is about the activation of AMPK. And I know when you interviewed him, you mentioned that that's normally a good thing. That's fasting, exercise, you know, activates all those downstream effectors. I think there's potentially something to the activation of AMPK in the fed state. So AMPK is supposed to be when you have a decrease in glycogen, you are reducing energy storage, energy availability. But activating that pathway in the presence of food or in the fed state, I think could be potentially detrimental. And there's a study that gave resveratrol, high-dose resveratrol, to people with type 2 diabetes and actually saw a worsening of blood glucose regulation. And that's the same thing. You're activating those fasting exercise-based pathways in somebody who's chronically overfed. And I wonder if that's potentially where how you can reconcile some of those pathways and some of the negative effects.
It's possible, but there may be an alternative explanation for the diabetic approach, because what I've started to digging deeply into the literature is that this Paul goes into it, but it doesn't really go into great detail into the oxidative damage mechanisms. And once you do, it becomes really obvious what some of the solutions are. But he does talk about peroxynitrite. When I went to medical school, which is well before you did, this was not even discovered. We didn't know about this. It's relatively recent, but it's a reactive nitrogen species that's formed when you combine superoxide with nitric oxide. And it probably is one of the most pernicious reactive species in the body. And this wasn't known prior when the oxidative damage theory of health was always thought to be the hydroxyl free radical. And that is more pernicious. But what many people fail to appreciate is that it's very, very short lived. It lasts like 10 to the minus ninth, a billionth of a second. An artifact of that length of its half-life is it can't travel very far. It literally only travels a distance of one protein or two proteins at the most. So if you generate them inside the inner mitochondrial membrane, it's not going out. It's not escaping. So it's only damaging the mitochondrial contents, and it's not damaging the nuclear stuff. But this peroxynitrate can live billions of times longer, and it easily passes in and out of the cell membranes that can damage distant structures, especially the DNA. In his paper, he didn't really talk about it too much, but he referenced this one article, which was by Paul Pacher, P-A-L-P-A-C-H-E-R, and the title of the article is Nitric Oxide and Peroxynitrite in Health and Disease. 140-page paper with 1,500 references. It's one of the most epic papers I've ever read. And if you are not up to date on oxidative damage to the biological systems, then I would strongly encourage everyone to get this article. It's totally free. Just type it in Google. It'll pop right up, and it's free in PubMed, full text. So when you get that, you realize this peroxynitrite, one of its most significant downsides is that it damages the DNA, and that fortunately, our biology has the capacity to repair that mechanism, to repair the damage, and it does it through a family of enzymes called PARP, poly-ADP ribose polymerases. And the problem with these, not the problem, they work greatly, but they run out of fuel, and the fuel they need is NAD. The reason I went on this tangent is the same fuel that's disrupted in diabetes. There's whole loads of pathways that are disrupted, and they run into NAD deficiencies. And there's a lot of interesting new research now suggesting that replenishing NAD stores can go quite a long ways to repairing much of the foundational molecular pathology in diabetes.
Yeah, so this is the idea of reductive stress. You almost have too much NADH compared to the unreduced or oxidized NAD, which you need for other things like DNA repair.
Well, it's not necessarily reductive stress, because the converse, I think an equivalent to one of the major pioneers who deserves Nobel Prize, but will never get it because of his communication skills and he's really cantankerous, is Richard Veitch. Richard Veitch. I mean, the guy is brilliant. Yeah. And I've been communicating with his associate, Bill Curtis, who actually writes most of his papers now. And I had a two-hour call with him this morning. And he helped me understand this whole family of NAD coenzymes, which includes not only NAD, NADP, and their oxidized and reduced versions, but also coenzyme A and ADP, or ATP. So they all work together. And it's the NADPH, which a lot of people don't fully appreciate. That is the true battery of the cell. Some people think it's the mitochondria, but it's really NADPH, which provides the reductive potential to regenerate and recharge your antioxidants like glutathione and ascorbate and tocopherol and allow them to continue their work.
Yeah, I think they published a paper on this in IUBMB Life, looking at the effects of their or suggesting that one of the benefits of their exogenous ketone ester would be to supply NADPH in the absence of a functional pentose phosphate pathway. We can link to that in the show notes. So we've completely gone off track here.
Yeah.
But NAD, NADPH, you know, you're talking my language.
Yeah, I know. That's why I was excited to talk to you.
Okay, let's get back to the EMFs. And I wanted to maybe just talk a little bit about symptomatology. You know, what are we potentially seeing in patients, clients, ourselves? How can we maybe reconcile that with the mechanisms that you talked about earlier?
Yeah, that's the reason I delve into the mechanisms, because if you understand the mechanisms and the damage at a biological level that it's being caused by this, and you can understand what you'd anticipate. Now, the tissues with the highest density of these voltage-gated calcium channels tends to be the neurological tissues, so the brain and the pacemaker in the heart. So that's why if you're treating someone or know someone or even yourself has a cardiac arrhythmia, then I think one of the first things you absolutely have to do is evaluate your EMF exposures and address that first, because it's clearly a high likelihood that's going to be a case. But the other damage at a systemic level would be an increase in your risk of simple cancers. And we're seeing, you know, a radical increase in brain tumors now and glioblastomas. And you almost always on the same side, the ipsilateral side that the cell phone is used. That would be a major one, because it causes such a massive increase in oxidative damage overall that you're going to increase virtually every chronic degenerative disease. And now you're going to have the disease, it'll result in disease, but with respect to having symptoms, you may not have symptoms. There are a certain percentage of the population, and I'm not sure why they experience this, maybe 2-3% who are considered EMH, electromagnetically hypersensitive, and sometimes called canaries. And they will be sensitive. They can tell you when they walk into a room and there's high EMF signals, and you can validate that objectively with equipment. And they're actually, the human body is biologically more sensitive than these equipment, but you can confirm their exposure. So they're not faking it. It's truly an issue.
Again, listening to Ole Johansson speak, this is a electro-hypersensitivity is a recognized disability in many countries, including Sweden, which is where he's from. You know, this is like a recognized thing. And actually, his argument is that when somebody has a disability or decrease in functional capacity, then it's actually upon the government or the population to alter the environment such that they no longer have their functional inability, just like you would put ramps for people in wheelchairs, right? So providing spaces where people aren't continuously exposed to these things would be the obvious effect of that, but that doesn't seem to be happening.
No, and it's precisely because of what I mentioned earlier. You have a massively powerful telecommunications industry, and no way in hell is going to let that thing happen, because it's an admission of guilt. In 2011, the World Health Organization reluctantly admitted that cell phones were a class 2B carcinogen. That means a probable carcinogen. I think they're wrong. I think it's a 1A, just like cigarettes. And in fact, in my view, cell phones are indeed the cigarettes of the 21st century. No question in my mind. And just like cigarettes were in the 20th century, the vast majority of the population, and certainly the media and the professionals and the experts, said that they did not cause cancer, and they persisted. I mean, you can still look at some of these congressional testimonies of the CEOs of the tobacco companies and just lying through their teeth. And now we laugh at that, but the same darn thing is happening with telecommunications. That's not going to change. And like there was a, I think it was a Surgeon General Coop who catalyzed a lot of the transition, but I don't think we're going to have that in the next 10, 20, 30 years. I think we're going to still continue to reap the damage that these exposures are doing to us.
Let's talk about potential long-term effects. And I think one of the things that's been studied most readily is fertility, particularly in males. And there's some interesting studies in rats that basically show within 4 to 5 generations of being exposed to cell phone type EMFs, you get an almost complete infertility. And so I think humans, we're currently in the first, second generation maybe of these kind of high level exposures. It's easy to sound melodramatic, but you know, can you envision, maybe talk about some of the science and then maybe the long-term effects of that on the human species?
Yeah, well, the title of my book is The EMF Extinction Event. I mean, that's a working title. The publisher might change that. But, you know, the book's not going to be out for 2 years, so because I'm just massively engrossed in these mechanisms. But you are right. Fertility is one issue. And Paul is good at describing how that obviously, if the fertility of the species goes down, that's one issue. But you have two others, that the rate of autism, which, of course, there are many contributing factors, but I think it's really quite clear that EMF is one of them. When I was in medical school, the rate of autism was 1 in 10,000 children. It's now down to 1 in 36, heading rapidly towards 1 in 2. So if you have half of the population being autistic on the beginning end, which takes an enormous amount of support, and on the other end of the spectrum, you've got half of the population coming down with Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases, then how can a species possibly survive? I mean, you've got 50% reduction in fertility that's continuing to increase. I mean, it's a prescription for extinction.
again, I come back to the thought about how it's very easily become something that just sounds so outworldly. It sounds almost impossible that these things could be. So I'd like to talk more about remediation and other things, how we can build this into sort of our general thinking framework. But how do we start sensible conversations about this? Because obviously this isn't going to be a top-down
thing anytime soon.
So how do we start to, you know, have sensible conversations where people don't immediately start to talk about tinfoil hats and hiding under the cupboard and actually maybe think about integrating these thought processes beyond the kind of sphere that we exist in?
I think the process is very similar to any other issue, especially if you're interested in natural health and you're, say, you're seeking to reduce your risk of the number one risk of death in the United States, which is heart disease. Well, you can go the conventional route and take statins and take blood pressure medications on aspirin to thin your blood, or you can do an alternative and forget the statins and not choose to use those. So it's a matter of doing the due diligence and becoming personally aware and educated. And interestingly, you continue to refoil a tinfoil hat. I think the best book until mine is written for the average person who isn't an expert in this and doesn't really want to go deep into the science, because this is really written for the lay person, is A Tinfoil Hat Guide to EMFs by Nicholas Pineau. So that's a great book for the average person. Get them up to speed. And so many practical recommendations in there.
I've read the book, and he also has an online course that I've watched. And you're right, for the lay person, it's great, but I must admit that if he could get a scientist to explain the science, I think he'd really benefit from that. Because there were just some areas where it was a little bit uncomfortable to watch this, because he's obviously not a scientist, so you could kind of tell. But I think those are definitely useful places to start. And there's a huge number of references, right? If you want to actually dig into the research and see the sort of evidence to support this, that definitely exists.
How to remediate. So that's the practical issue, is that you have to convert these invisible exposures to visible. So you need some type of device to do that. Fortunately, they do exist. The one of my favorites is called the Acousticom 2. It was introduced to me by Magda Havas, who's a really pretty good researcher on this. I'm actually going to interview her in a few months and help people understand this at a really deep level. But once you have a device like this, and they're very hard to find, they're on obscure websites like Amazon, and it costs about $150, and it's an analog meter so that it will give you an acoustic sound, which is why they call it Acousticom, but also show you visually on a scale of different LED lights ranging from no lights to green, yellow, orange, and then red. And, you know, as you escalate up the scale, it's a higher exposure. I think they're using it in volts per meter, which is actually probably one of the better units that you can use. There's probably at least three different units you can use to measure the radio frequency. Now, the Acousticom is only measuring radio frequency exposures, which is probably one of the most significant ones. So that's your cell phone, that is your Wi-Fi router, and your neighbor's Wi-Fi router are smart meters. So pick all of those up, and then you can start going around your house and seeing what your exposures are so you can actually know them. And then you can seek to remediate from that perspective. And I am pretty confident that nearly everyone who does that will be really surprised to see what their exposures are. And when I was in the Dr. Levy group and academically acknowledged that there was some issue here, but I wasn't going to change my lifestyle about it until I was mentored by Dr. Klinghart, one of my longtime physician mentors, and he's a prominent physician who treats ill people from all over the world, and he actually refuses to treat patients unless they're willing to address their EMF issues because, in his experience, they're just not going to get better. It's always a significant issue.
What kind of extent does that require to reduce your exposure in a biologically meaningful way? And the reason why I ask that is because one of my general tenets of developing sustainable long-term health is that you should control the things that you can control, but the things you can't control, you just shouldn't worry about them because the worry is
absolutely
worse.
Absolutely agree.
And actually one of our clients recently pointed out that that's actually very similar to the Serenity Prayer. Accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things that I can, and then the wisdom to know the difference. So is this something where we can meaningfully reduce our exposures, like considering the fact that the neighbor has the Wi-Fi and there's a cell phone tower across the street? And
most of the exposure you have within your home comes from inside your home. So that's a good thing. And when you have a Wi-Fi router on, it's like having a cell phone tower in your house. It's just massive. Yeah. So there's two simple things you can do is to prudently use your phone and turn off the Wi-Fi router, or better yet, get a router that has no Wi-Fi capacity at all. Because if they turn it off with software, like they can do a firmware update and it comes back on, or they just mess it up. But you're going to have to measure it pretty much every day to make sure that there's no radiation coming from that thing. So you can radically reduce it. If you have other exposures because of your location, your neighborhood, you can fortunately shield most of that, at least radio frequency fields. So that would be relatively easy to do. And you can basically, if you use a notebook or your desktop, you have to put everything in airplane mode if you're wired. Because I had my desktop and it had a wired connection, and I just thought that was enough. But no, you've got to go into the settings and put it in airplane mode. Otherwise, it's blasting you with Wi-Fi too. And things like smart TVs, they call them smart. Smart is just like the term diet, which is a pseudonym for artificial sweeteners. Well, smart means wireless. That's what it means. So if it's a smart device, it's wireless. So they've got smart thermostats, smart toothbrushes. You want to turn it into airplane mode, everything into airplane mode, and get wired connections. And you do that around your home. And yes, I would thoroughly agree with your assessment. You shouldn't stress over exposures you have no control over, and I certainly don't. But once your home and your office, and especially your bedroom, you've got to get those right. The bedroom exposures are probably the most important, because that's when you're repairing and regenerating. And if you're exposed to these frequencies where you're sleeping, you're just simply not going to get the benefits of sleep. And you know very well, as everyone listening does, how important sleep is.
Let's talk a little bit about shielding maybe. And this is personally interesting to me because we bought a new house about a year ago now. And after some dinging around, I found the smart meter on the wall outside our bedroom window. And I can't say I noticed any specific effects, but I'll also say that I saw that. And the first thing I did is I bought a Faraday cage. I thought for $100, risk benefit, potential benefit, literally no downside to me. So I stuck it on the outside.
A Faraday cage around the meter.
Around the meter, yeah.
Okay, and that still allowed the signal to get out to send the utility company their data?
Yeah, nobody's come knocking on my door telling me that they're not getting the data. So there's obviously still some signal coming out. So can you then talk about maybe whether you think that might have a real effect and other kinds of shielding we should think about?
Ideally, the best way is to not to have it. That's a little more costly. Yeah. I have to pay $25 a month to my utility company to not have a smart meter. And I'm happy to pay it, even though it is legal extortion for the most part. No, I'm serious. It really is.
Did you prevent them from installing a new smart meter because you already had an old type of meter? Or did you have a smart meter and then ask them specifically to remove it?
I had this home before they made the transition, and it was the transition was delayed because they have solar panels, which is another issue that we should talk about because it's dirty electricity, and they introduce a whole different set of frequencies which can complicate things in the electrical fields. I never had a smart meter at this house. My old house in Chicago, I actually put a cage around that because the utility company there was a little bit, they did not give you an option. They said, you have to install this. So I put a cage up, and then after they were unable to remove the cage, and it was like an iron cage around there, they couldn't through it. And then they gave me an option of paying for not to have it installed.
This reminded me of a conversation I had with a coworker at the lab at the University of Washington. And he certainly doesn't think about all the kind of things that we do. It exists in this sort of more holistic, say, health kind of field. But even he was talking about the fact that the electric company wants to put a smart meter on his house. And he was like, I'm pretty sure that's not going to be a good thing for me and my family. So even somebody who hadn't really thought about this figured that that probably wasn't a good idea. So I think they offered him to just pay each month, and that's what he's going to do. So other shielding options, things that people should maybe consider if there are other exposures that they can't control, but they might want to.
Yeah, there are materials that you can use that are fabrics that you can use up like shears that will block many of the radio frequencies. And you can create a Faraday cage over your bed. I don't prefer to do that. We have actually created a product that we're hoping to release earlier or later this year, which is a Faraday sleeping bag. Little sleeping tent that you can carry with you conveniently in your luggage as you go to different hotel locations, as many of us travel to conferences. Every hotel is a significant issue for the most part. Although there's two issues. One is the radio frequencies, which are usually very high, and you can remediate that somewhat by taking the lowest floor. I have status in most of the major hotel chains, so I can get the best floors and everything, but I always go to the lowest floor. If I get the first floor, that's great. Most of the time you can't at a big hotel, but sometimes the smaller ones, I get the first floor. Why? Because the other buildings will shield it. In fact, you can even go outside with these meters and like there's a metal fence and you can go have the measurements on your side of the fence and then put the meter over the fence and you'll see the readings go up significantly higher. So it's something as simple as a metal fence will block it. Certainly building materials will block it. Windows are very transparent. It's like almost nothing's there. It comes right through it. These EMF frequencies are pretty similar to visible light. So if you can see something through it, then EMFs are coming through.
Okay. So then how are we maybe able to track whether this is truly having an effect.
Well, you got to measure it. You got to measure it.
So you can measure before and after you've done any kind of remediation or, you know, with any kind of blocking or shielding. But what about downstream of that? How can you measure whether reducing your exposure is having a beneficial biological effect?
If you're already sick and damaged, then you may see a benefit. But if you're someone like yourself, I have never met you personally. I was hoping I'd meet you at PaleoFX. We never connected.
My wife got a big prize in Europe, so we were able to do that instead. I had a spot to speak, but I wanted to support her instead.
I would be disappointed if you didn't, but but I was looking forward to meeting with you. So someone like yourself, well, I've never met, but I imagine that you're incredibly healthy. You're obviously athletic and you're knowledgeable and you're doing the right things. I mean, you're probably in the upper 0.1% of people who are healthy. So you're not going to notice a darn thing. You're doing something proactively to prevent it. Just like you're not going to notice any changes in optimizing your cholesterol patterns, yet you're radically reducing your risk for heart disease. So it's the same type of process. Although you may notice an improvement in thinking. Mental clarity. Okay. And interestingly, there's a tremendous synergy between the cyclical ketogenesis and optimizing performance with athletics and optimizing the biology to radically reduce your risk of oxidative damage. I mean, it's the same darn process. They work together perfectly.
And we measure oxidative stress in various ways in our clients. One of them being 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine in the urine.
Is that a relatively inexpensive test to do?
Yeah, it comes as part of some organic acids tests or part of Dutch tests, which measures hormones or hormone end products or byproducts in the urine. But then it also measures that plus some neurotransmitters. Yeah.
I like that because that ultimately, to me, that's one of the most significant ones is the DNA damage. And if you can, you have low DNA damage, which you can easily do by reducing the Parex and nitrate exposure and activating PARP and repairing that damage, then you're in the races. So that would be an excellent objective way to monitor it, but it's not going to really change your symptoms, I wouldn't think, unless you're sick already.
Yeah. One thing we didn't talk about was that effect on DNA damage, which is sort of like the standard argument is that it's non-ionizing radiation, therefore it can't break molecular bonds, therefore it can't be damaging unless it's heating. So can you maybe talk about some of the evidence which suggests that that's not the case?
Thank you for reminding that is the standard argument that is used by the industry. And they are correct, as you opened up at the beginning, that the charged particles inside and out of the cell do not vibrate at a high enough rate to generate enough heat. So their argument is absolutely correct. It does not cause thermal damage. The problem is almost all of it is non-thermal damage. And that goes back to the voltage-gated calcium channels, which are, according to Paul's calculations, 7.2 million times more sensitive than these charged particles inside and outside the cell. So that means that the safety standards that are established by the industry are off by a factor of 7.2 million.
And there's at least two sets of studies. I think the original one by Lay and Singh looking at the effects on DNA damage, and then the Reflex study corroborated that. And that was actually partly funded by the industry to try and discredit them. And then they found the same thing, that turning on a cell phone next to themselves could show DNA damage.
I think that's where they were doing the COMET assays. It was probably one of the most sensitive lab assays for DNA damage. The other point I'd like to mention that people don't appreciate is the difference between ionizing and ionizing radiation. As you mentioned, the ionizing radiation has enough energy to bust the covalent bonds in the DNA. But that's not how most of the DNA damage is done. It's done through oxidative damage because the energy also will generate hydroxy-free radicals right in the nucleus because it can do it. Normally, the hydroxyls don't make it to the nucleus because most all of them are generated in the mitochondria. They don't get to the nucleus, but they do when you're exposed to ionizing radiation. So that's what causes the damage. It's not so much the energy from the bonds directly. It's cascading downhill side effects that creates the damage.
And that's what you're getting.
Yeah, that's exactly what you're getting with EMF. It's the same mechanism, same darn mechanism. So there's very little difference between a CAT scan. In fact, one of the studies we reviewed was they only used 3G, not 4G, or certainly even 5G. They compared the cellular stress and oxidative damage from 3G to about 1,600 chest x-rays.
Yeah, and that's, you know, a handful of CAT scans. Yes. They'll readily admit that that's a cancer risk.
Yes.
Something that if you need to get it, but it's certainly not something you want to be doing frequently.
So here's a good point, and I think many people listening to this are educated professionals. They travel regularly, and they're exposed to gamma radiations at 35,000 feet, and they or themselves or their family or their friends are going to require a CAT scan for whatever reason, even if they're unable to get an MRI, which I think is a safer alternative. So what do you do in those cases where it's unavoidable exposure? And I've come to some conclusion. I bet you'd like to see what those would be.
Absolutely.
What's my airplane strategy to address ionizing radiation, which will also address the non-ionizing radiation? The first is fasting. So if you're going to take a flight, especially a morning flight, do not eat. Do not eat at all. assuming you've been following a really good diet before, you're going to have a general baseline of nutritional ketosis. And do some high-intensity exercises. If you've been on my site, you probably know about the nitric oxide dump developed by Zach Bush, which is 4 minutes. You can do it anywhere. You can do it at the gate. You can do it waiting for your luggage. So do it before you get out there, because the combination of fasting with no food and no glucose will generate ketones, which will charge up NADPH, which will charge your antioxidants intracellularly and increase the SOD and catalase, so that you can minimize the production. And if you want to take it to the next level, you could do exogenous ketones. Obviously, there's the salts and the esters. I think the esters are far more powerful, like kind of like Veatch's ones with the 1,3-butanediol, beta-hydroxybutyrates. But you'd have to take about 15 grams. Now, if you're going to do a CT scan, I would definitely do that. I would do probably 30 grams. It's going to be pricey, though, because they're $1 a gram. Then you can use NRF2 upregulators like molecular hydrogen. I like the high dose tablets, the 9 milligrams per deciliter that have nanobubbles. Most of them are not, so you have to shop real carefully. And I take a few of those every day, actually. This intermittent cyclical pulsed exposure, which will more aggressively upregulate the NRF2 pathway, which increases SOD and catalase and NADPH. So that's what you want to do. And then CBD is another thing that can increase it too. So those are the strategies that I would recommend for flying or exposure to ionizing radiation.
I saw you mentioned the molecular hydrogen. It was something that I'd been meaning to dig into for a while. And I did have a chance to sort of piece through some references. And there is some very interesting stuff there. So we're looking at 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine we mentioned in athletes and people with rheumatoid arthritis, other inflammatory conditions. And you can see that come down after treatments with molecular hydrogen. So I certainly thought that was something that was kind of new to me, but that certainly seems to have some stuff behind it. So there's something that we created or I designed called Hormi Tea. It's a tea that's based on matcha, broccoli seeds, some turmeric, some blueberry anthocyanin. So that's kind of designed to sort of help upregulate those similar pathways. And we've actually had people try them out. And when they try them during fasting, they seem to get an increase in ketone production, which is interesting,
yeah,
at least. So maybe something like that too.
With the fasting and the exercise, you can measure it, but you probably won't notice an increase in ketones. It doesn't mean it's not working, because the ketones are being utilized to creating fatty acids. And then at production, they're creating NADPH, which is exactly what you want to do. You want to recharge your cellular battery. So you're not going to be able to document that by measuring your ketones, but it doesn't mean you're getting benefit.
Yeah, and it's the same with, you know, if anybody who spend a significant time in nutritional ketosis will know that you adapt and your ketone levels come down because of the balance of usage and production. You know, we've done a pretty whirlwind tour here. So first, in terms of treatment, we talked about magnesium earlier. That was on my list. That was one of the things that I know you've mentioned. Another thing that's come up is grounding, particularly grounding with mats and things like that.
Yes, I wanted to talk about two things. First, let me finish off the cell phone. So you have to be really, really careful with your cell phone. Here's the benefits of being careful. You will never run out of battery. Typically, my cell phone, I charge it every morning. And when I charge it, it's like 94% because it's not on. It's in airplane mode continuously. And I only use it to hail a Lyft or an Uber. And that's about it. When I'm traveling, I do not text, you know, stay off of it. Use your notebook computer, do not your cell phone. And please do not put it on your body unless it's in airplane mode. I mean, unless you've got to have it for some type of emergency, that should be the very, very rare exception. So that's a key thing that we can all do. It's easy. It doesn't cost a thing. You have to be less available. We all think that we're so important. We didn't all have cell phones before. You know, we weren't available 24/7. And now it's crazy. The expectation is that you are. And you could just change that, just making a personal choice. That's a massive thing. And this other one is the dirty electricity. I mentioned at the beginning, there's a lot of confusion about measuring electrical fields. But before I go there, I didn't talk about magnetic fields. And magnetic fields are quite significant, especially if they're coming from electrical equipment. That's not that hard to measure, even in meters like the tri-field can, which is called tri-field because it does measure magnetic, but it also measures electrical and radio frequencies, but it's terrible for the other two. It's relatively decent for magnetic, though. But there's a lot of meters that you can measure it. So you just get close to it, these devices, and usually it has to move something around or turn some equipment off. So you have to check for magnetic fields. It's really important to do, but they're relatively easy to find and fix. So it's not a big problem. The big problem is the electric fields. And primarily because of the introduction of these voltage transients. You know, the typical frequency in the US is 60 hertz, and in Europe, of course, it's 50. And that's a biological signal. That is within normal biology. That shouldn't be harmful, and I believe it isn't. It's only harmful, these electrical fields, because they have superimposed on it these high voltage transients. This typically start about 2 kilohertz to go up to 100 kilohertz. And that's the typically termed dirty electricity, and Sam Milham wrote a book on that. And it's these high voltage transients which actually cause the damage. And you can remove them unless you have a really high source like a photovoltaic inverter like I do, like three of them. And I've got to get specific filters installed inside the inverters to do that. But anytime you have a voltage gated or voltage switching power supply, it will introduce these high voltage transients into the electricity. And it doesn't have to be in your house. It could be your neighbors. So why am I talking about this when you ask me about grounding? It's because I've radically changed my position on grounding. And unless I'm in Europe, I do not ground. I'll walk on the beach and the ocean. It's a little bit different, but I do not physically ground in a hotel or in my home because the ground is contaminated because the power utilities legally are required to have a return wire to get the electricity back to the power station, but they don't. They're not prosecuted for this. They allow the ground current to occur through the ground, which contaminates the ground current in virtually every place in the United States. I mean, there's some remote isolated rural areas where it probably isn't an issue, but in most of the U.S. it is. So that's why I do not ground. But fortunately, there is a solution for this dirty electricity. There's filters that you can put into your outlets, and there's a meter that you need to use in conjunction with it to see, you know, how many filters you need in a room and where they need to be located. So a Stetzer filter is my favorite. He's the guy that developed it with Martin Graham, who's since passed and, in fact, has been significantly influencing the Russian health community on this, and they've actually implemented standards based on his filters. And this group of electrical professionals actually honored the Graham and Stetzer by having the units that they measure, which are energy units, the Graham Stetzer units. So that's what they measure with this meter. You could pick them up, the Stetzer filters. There's GreenWave also. I like Dave's a little better. But if you're going to buy them, I wouldn't buy them online at his site. I would call the company because they offer special deals when they do that. So you can get them at a lot lower price. And typically, you're going to need about 20 or 40 in a typical home. And I think that's really important, especially in your bedroom.
Can you talk about how they work? Where are they exerting their action to reduce?
Basically, it's a capacitor that filters out those frequencies. Okay. And it does use some electrical current, but it's not charged to you. It's charged to the electric company. So it doesn't cost you a penny extra to run these things.
Okay. I think I read somewhere, and I haven't had a chance to dig into it, that some of these filters generate quite significant magnetic fields as a result of their action. Is that something people should be worried about?
They generate very high magnetic fields, but if you use a meter, any decent meter, you'll see the magnetic field drops off to zero within about 3 or 4 inches. So you want to sleep on top of them for sure. Here's the other really important pearl, is that you really need to hire someone to make sure that there are no wiring errors in your home. And about a third of the homes do, at least in California. If you have a wiring error, you put these filters, you're going to make it worse. Actually, plugging in anything into a circuit with a wiring error will make it worse and introduce a whole loads of problems. So it's really important to have a qualified professional evaluate your specific home to make sure there's no wiring errors.
So start by getting an electrician or somebody to come in and look at the wiring before you start installing them.
Yeah, but they got to know what they're doing. I mean, most don't. The building biologists would know how to figure that out, but they're really confused about the filters. I'm kind of leveraging my platform to have them come to the table and discuss with Stetzer that we're all aligned on the same issue. But there's a lot of confusion about dirty electricity in the building biology community.
Is there anything else that you think people should know in this kind of sphere? Anything that we didn't cover?
I think that's a big one. I'm kind of liking the EMF tents. One other thing, too, when you're in hotels and you're traveling, it's important. Commercial requirements in the building codes, primarily for safety standards and fire remediation, is to put all electrical cables in a metal conduit in commercial buildings. That's not required for residences. So if you're in a hotel, obviously a commercial building, unless it's some ancient hotel, it's historic or something, but if it's a conventional hotel, all you got to do is when you get in there is pull all the cords that are plugged into the outlets out. Because the moment you plug that in, it's going to take the electrical field into the room. And if you plug it out, it stays behind the wall. Now, that won't work in your home because you don't have a shielded metal cable.
Okay. That makes sense. That's a good tip. And actually, one thing that I wanted to talk about back in my notes is the hierarchy of thinking about these things. And, you know, I think anybody who has their head screwed on in any normal way, you know, agrees on food and sleep and distress tolerance and love and social connection, all that stuff in terms of health. But the next most important thing that comes up seems to vary very much from practitioner to practitioner. It could be like everybody has chronic Lyme or it's mold or deuterium or EMFs or toxic exposures or something. So do you have a hierarchy of what's kind of important and what to address first? And kind of the reason why, or one of the reasons I asked this is because we worked with somebody who had very much gone down the EMF kind of route and had built a Faraday cage around their bed and all this kind of stuff because they had cell phone towers nearby, but still couldn't sleep because they hadn't addressed all this sort of basic stuff first. So do you have a hierarchy or a sequence of approach?
Yeah, that's a good question. A Faraday cage won't stop dirty electricity, so they may need some dirty electric filters. But I think, like most experts, I would say is that the diet has got to be number one. Now, previously, up until I think last night, which I came to a different conclusion, it was like 80% of the issue, but it probably is a lot less than that. The exercise is maybe nearly as important, primarily because of its influence on PGC1 alpha. And its ability to increase mitochondrial biogenesis and stimulate NRF2 and radically reduce oxidative stress. So, I mean, that's a key feature. If you're not engaged in some type of regular movement exercise program, you're really missing the boat. Obviously, diet and exercise, that's preaching to the choir, of course. But I think EMF is a big thing. Certainly diet, exercise, and EMF, which are relatively simple to do, and focusing on those is going to normalize most of the problem. Now, it's certainly not going to be the magic bullet for everyone, but that's the foundational basis that you have to really start at and then fine-tune it from there.
Hopefully, we'll have stimulated some thought processes in the listeners, and either they'll think that I've joined you in going off the reservation, or they're sort of interested in finding out more, either layperson or tactics on how to improve things, or maybe they want to, you know, look at the science because they're still not quite convinced. So do you have places you'd like to send people to find out more information based on what it is they'd like to figure out?
Yeah, there's a lot of good books out there. I think Martin Blank, probably one of the best scientific books to really evaluate the studies. He just recently passed away a few weeks ago. His book on EMF would be excellent. It's really more geared towards health professional than Nick's book. So That's where I would stop. And I would listen to some of the interviews I've done. Just type in EMF on our interviews. And you know, I've done half a dozen. I've got a lot more lined up. I really want to dig a lot more into the molecular biology of this, because I think once you understand the mechanism, you know, that was the problem. You know, and I think one of the other reasons, other than it's invisible, is that we knew it was non-thermal for 2 decades. I mean, that's been published. But, you know, that's an ambiguous, nebulous, ethereal concept. But once you know the mechanism and understand it, then it becomes more real. Mm-hmm. Just digging into the science and understanding it from your perspective, I think it's going to help motivate you to actually take action and not be in delusional denial or being failing to implement it. It's something I call FTI, and so many of us are guilty of that. We know it, but we're not implementing strategies which is going to remediate the exposures.
Yeah. Arming yourself with that information is the first step. And then the behavior change is obviously the thing that I think practitioners probably struggle with the most, but that's the next step. So we'll link to Nick's book. You mentioned all of your videos. I've also collected various interesting papers I read on the way. We'll link to the Bioinitiative report published a few years ago, like thousands of papers.
1,700 studies they linked to document the damage. Telecommunications, there's no studies that show that it causes harm. They got 1,700 of them.
Yeah, and similar number of pages, truly epic. And that doesn't, I mean, I haven't read the whole thing. But again, if people...
Oh, I'm disappointed.
I downloaded it last night. I thought I should get some sleep. So if people really want to look at what's out there, then we'll make all of that stuff available. So this has been great. It's been a pleasure to talk to you in person. Is there anything else you'd like people to look at?
I just want to thank you for all your work. I mean, you're really one of the upcoming leaders out there helping people understand this at a deeper level, you know, where you've got the science training and a clinical training. It's an unusual combination. So thank you for everything you're doing.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.